Welcome to The Last American Vagabond. Thank you for joining me today. We have a special guest joining us, somebody we haven't had on for quite a while, and that is Whitney Webb, T-Lab writer and editor-in-chief of Unlimited Hangout, wearing a great sweatshirt today. How are you?
Hey, you know, all right, all things considered, just like everyone else.
Yeah.
You know, the crazier things get, it's just like, gotta roll with it at this point.
Yeah, you kind of have to. And that's the all things considered kind of, you know, we are all aware that we're in a really hard situation right now, but it's, you can't do, I mean, what something I always generally say is like, even if we knew like this, we could never overtake what's happening right now. People like us, people like you, we can't just sit back and do nothing. I mean, that's just not in the cards for us, right?
So it's, well, that's like, what they want anyway.
Exactly. You know? Exactly.
So, yeah.
But we're here today to discuss some recent work you did, actually a great segment you did on the Lawyers Committee for 9/11 Inquiry special on Rumble and Super U. And I thought you did a really great speech there, and you a recent article for Mint Press News, I believe, that was also really well done. And we're kind of just going to have a broad discussion today because, you know, Whitney and I love to get in our hypothetical conversations about what's going to be happening in the future. but today we want to start off by discussing something. I mean, the overarching point today, as I said in the title, and this is something Whitney has really done a great job in covering, and something her and I have talked about quite a bit based on her research, is that this is, and as Corbett said, many people pointed this out, that this biosecurity state, which is what we're seeing develop in front of us today, is part two of where the security state started. 9/11 was the part one. This is part two. Whether, you know, that's a broad statement to make, it's clear that there are some connections between the two. And so we're going to start off today by talking about some gaslighting that's been happening around the 9/11 conversation. And I think this is, you know, not surprising the people that we're seeing this come from. But at the end of the day, I think the bigger point for me is that it's an obvious time for this to be happening, not just because of the anniversary, but because at least as we're seeing it, this is a beginning point to what's happening today. So it makes sense to kind of cover up the origins or you know, gaslight the narrative around that, so it helps hide what's really happening today. So start wherever you want, Whitney, if you want to jump into your conversations from before and what you just did on those speeches, or jump right into that article. Whatever you want to start with.
Sure. I mean, there's a lot of different things I guess I could say to start off with, you know, but we're 20 years from the events of 2001, which I want to stress, you know, isn't just 9/11, like the anthrax attacks came after that. I did a lot of work on that last year, and other people have done a lot of work on them, researching them, investigating them over the years as well. And essentially that was meant to be something much bigger than it was. It was traced back to the U.S. military source much too quickly for it to have been, have followed through with what was supposed to happen there, which was blame it on Iraq, working with Al-Qaeda, provide a link to Saddam Hussein that 9/11's official story failed to provide, but the Bush administration was desperate to create that link, and the anthrax attacks were meant to do that, but that whole narrative fell apart. So, you know, what we see a lot with 9/11 20 years on is, you know, never forget the Twin Towers, but forget Building 7, forget the anthrax attacks, and all of that stuff, right? So, you know, there's a lot to reflect on 20 years since then. And, you know, obviously a lot of people were having, you know, their takes and opinions about that this past Saturday. but something that I thought was really important to write about and what my op-ed about was in Mint Press on Saturday is that I think even today, people that frame themselves or outlets that frame themselves, you know, as being against empire, as being against, you know, the state to an extent, adversarial, are completely unwilling a lot of times to question the official story of 9/11 in any capacity. Right. And how not being willing to do that is responsible in some ways for what we've seen over the past year and a half in terms of willing to challenge narratives and ask the hard questions. You know, it was sort of isolated. There was a fragmentation in independent media at that point with the whole COVID thing. And some people were willing to, you know, ask those questions and take those risks, and others were not. And a lot of this, I think, comes down, you know, there's a lot of parallels between the people that were willing to ask those hard questions and take those professional risks with COVID-19 and those who are willing to question the official story of 9/11 versus, you know, the other category being people that don't question the official story and aren't really willing to go very far or go anywhere at all in questioning what's happened over the past year and a half. So, you know, that's essentially what this is about in a nutshell. And I just think it's, you know, there's a lot of ways to sort of pick apart 9/11, right? Mm-hmm. A lot of threads to pull on there for those that have ever looked into it.
Even for the community too.
Yeah, but I think, you know, for me anyway, the base point to start from is, okay, the official story is supposed to be the story authored by the 9/11 commission, right? Mm-hmm. But, you know, the chair and vice chair of that commission wrote a book, and other commissioners that were there, that were involved in writing the official story, said the same thing. Their powers of investigation were oddly limited. They were starved of funds. The official story, per its own authors, is incomplete, it's flawed, and it can't answer fundamental questions about that day. So the fact that we can't even question it when the authors say it's incomplete, flawed, and can't answer fundamental questions about that day is totally insane. And so, you know, that we have to, you know, sort of pick apart, like I do in this piece for MitPress, why do people refuse to question the official story? So I think in independent media, the people that refuse to question it more often than not are doing it from the perspective of career preservation and self-preservation. They want to continue to be published in certain outlets that want to maintain this veneer of like mainstream legitimacy, I guess, while right. also simultaneously not being mainstream. Right. Because in order to be mainstream, you can't question the 9/11 story. We've been gaslit over the past 20 years to think that anyone who questions the official story, despite what the people on the 9/11 commission, you know, themselves say, that questioning it is irrational. It's unpatriotic. It's just like super, it's even treasonous. You know, it's all these different awful things, which is, you know, fundamentally, I would argue, an irrational perspective itself.
Yeah.
But, you know, essentially, and then of course there's the class of people who don't work in independent media and don't have that kind of incentive, but they don't want to acknowledge that the rosier worldview that you were taught in school, or that's like, you know, the prevailing worldview of the United States and United States government and all of that, you know, they don't really want to have those illusions shattered. They'd rather not live in a world like that, where 9/11 is something other than the official story and exploring the implications of that fully, you know, and so that's preserving a particular worldview. So that's, you could argue that's self-preservation in another sense, you know, but it's fundamentally comes down to that. But when it comes to independent media, you know, I think over the past year and a half, we've really seen the consequences of refusing to accept those hard truths and ask those hard questions, what that's led to, and how once an orthodox a narrative orthodoxy, an official narrative is established, like it has been with like COVID-19, for example, the same tactics about people who questioned 9/11 have been used over the past year and a half to great effect. You know, obviously there's differences, but there are some obvious similarities. And what we're seeing now is one segment of society, for example, calling to deprive another segment that they're being told is the bad guy and responsible for everything bad happening, the unvaccinated, for example, whatever, that they should be deprived of their freedoms. Whereas, you know, after 9/11, it was, oh, Muslim Americans are all a threat and they all need to be surveilled and they shouldn't have the same freedoms as the rest of us because of 9/11, you know, based on an erroneous official story. You know, if we're willing to be so easily gaslit and deceived and led into a situation where we're willing to deprive this group or that group or whatever group they tell us are the bad guys or the other of their freedom, then I mean, that's what's happening right now. And it happened after 9/11, and people that were critics of that aren't necessarily criticizing what's happening now. And by failing to address 9/11, we're not looking at the big picture of what all of this is. We have a case study in that. And, you know, by people that have chosen to portray 9/11 truthers as absolutely nuts within independent media have done a huge disservice, I think. And there's a lot of them. You know, I had a recent conversation with Mark Crispin Miller, the NYU professor. He traces a decent amount of this back to Noam Chomsky and people that really value Noam Chomsky or idealize him or imitate him within media, because he did certainly inspire a generation of mostly, you know, on the progressive side of things, you know, commentators and people in independent media. And he refuses to consider anything other than the 9/11 official story. Same with, you know, his view on the Kennedy assassination or any event like that. Even Jeffrey Epstein having any sort of intelligence ties is crazy talk to Noam Chomsky. And of course, his views on Syria and a lot of other things are really silly. So people have been using him for a long time as sort of their bellwether of, you know, what's adversarial and what's not. And that really needs to stop. Right. Cause that's no good. I mean, the guy is a gatekeeper essentially. And Corbett did a really good video on that. Chomsky even says that, Wall Street wasn't in the Federal Reserve. Sorry. The Federal Reserve had like no naughty role in the 2008 economic collapse and stuff. I mean, he goes pretty far to protect certain powerful interests, you know, while also, you know, challenging others. And, you know, it's a limited hangout, essentially, whether that's intentional on Chomsky or not. I'm not trying to like get into that, right? But, you know, the consequences are essentially the same. So we do have a lot of people that are unwilling to challenge the official narrative because they don't want to be called names. They don't want to be blacklisted from publishing in certain outlets. They don't want to be called, you know, conspiracy theorists and have that smear applied to them, you know, and it's really about self-preservation and fear. And ultimately, if we keep falling victim to this, to those urges, you know, it's been made pretty clear that most people will fall in line because of one of those two things. But, you know, and that is currently being used against us. And so I think, you know, fundamentally what we're facing is a crisis of courage, or a crisis of cowardice, depending on how you want to frame it, really, you know, within independent media, and it really needs to be called out and it needs to stop.
Yeah, I couldn't agree more. And it's really exactly the people are choosing to be more concerned about the longevity of their business, the business model they've created, or, you know, and to some degree, you almost can't fault people for, you know, playing that game because that's how the world works. But at the end of the day, when we're watching what's happening, it's like we need to put everything on the line for what's happening right now at all costs, the truth, the information we're trying to share. And I think it's really important to call this out today. And a lot of people might look at some of this stuff as, you know, internal kind of fighting. That's not really what's happening. You know, right now it's important that we call out the stuff that is trying to hide the reality of what I think is very clearly an end game here. So before we jump into the gaslighting discussion there, let's talk about the crossover really quickly for what you just described, because I think it's really interesting. Again, like you mentioned, the time when it was any Muslim American or any just Middle Eastern that was just by default a terrorist, and that we, regardless of how we pretend that's not really how that went down, we all remember that really polarized time where it doesn't matter, you know, and we act like that's not who we are, whether in the US or the UK, but it's obviously how the government uses these things. And I see the same thing happening with COVID-19, being called conspiracy theorists for saying anything, as well as a China overlap on that, right? Right now, from predominantly the Republican side of this conversation and the two-party illusion, China bad guy in every possible way, right? It doesn't matter if you're China linked, there's something bad there, because, you know, and really, in my opinion, I think it's overlap between both governments working together. That's my opinion. But what do you see there on the overlap, both between just COVID-19 as well as China specifically on that kind of idea we were just talking about?
Well, with China specifically, you have what you explained on the right, the sort of view that everything going on, the fourth industrial revolution, the Great Reset, is actually coming from the mastermind, the CCP, and all of this stuff, which I think is completely inaccurate. But then at the same time, on the progressive left, there's also this sort of like very cozy with China. China can do no wrong. China is much better. You know, where I recently published my op-ed on 9/11 in Press News, you know, they have a story I've had a couple of stories over the past year and a half, other opinion pieces by other people. They published essentially saying that, you know, if you don't support, well, the most recent one, implying that critics of the gain of function research going on at the Wuhan Institute of Virology are essentially orientalist and racist to an extent, which is, you know, an extreme way of looking at it too, I think, because I don't think those same writers would hold the same position if applied to Fort Detrick, for example, which also engages in that stuff on a regular basis. That particular, I think you're muted, Ryan, but that particular piece, which is, you know, they have up there right now, essentially says that it's silly to say that there is a, that the line between biodefense and biowarfare is razor thin and often crossed, but, you know, I would argue for someone that's looked into how the U.S. Research community, military, and whatever, Fort Detrick and so on, have used that and the actual risks that exist from gain of function. You know, I don't think that's very accurate, but, you know.
I totally agree.
I think, you know, Mint Press had a disclaimer on there just in their defense that they're trying to put out a lot of different viewpoints. They recently did publish mine, which obviously some of the other people that publish opinion pieces there probably didn't like very much at all. So, you know, that's to their credit, I guess. Yeah. But I personally don't agree with this latest piece.
The facts can sometimes upset people. You know, that's just how it goes.
Yeah, but what I think, one thing I do want to say about like what we have with the right in China right now, especially over the course of COVID-19, is sort of like what happened with the left on Russiagate. It's sort of like Chinagate. And conveniently, we have both main segments, political segments of U.S. society, left and right. Right. Both completely hating the two main adversaries of the United States very conveniently.
Interesting. And what's important to always note is, as you've made clear in your coverage of this, whether Russiagate or China, is that it's neither side. The two party paradigm likes to make it out to be one side's wrong and the other side has it. They're both obviously incorrect. Right. Like even with Russiagate, it's not the case. Or let's just take the case you just made. China is obviously not some altruistic entity out there fighting for your freedom. Right. They are just as dangerous and bad as everything we're pointing to. And so one side makes them out to be good. The other side makes them out to be bad. And it's usually somewhere in the middle, you know, and
It's cartoonish to be like Vladimir Putin is the source of everything bad in the world. And it's cartoonish to say Xi Jinping is the source of everything bad in the world. It doesn't really work like that. You know, these are people in charge of powerful, influential companies. If you look more often than not, the governments of both Russia and China have ties to a lot of the same suspect corporations or suspect entities, World Economic Forum, for example, things like that, have ties to all of these guys. You know, it's just, I think it's just sort of like a divide and conquer thing, really. And at the end of the day, you know, it benefits certain groups to have one segment of the U.S. focused on looking at one particular nation state as the bad guy, and the other segment looking at another particular nation state as the bad guy, when both of those nation states are adversaries. Adversaries of certain segments of the U.S. power structure, while at the same time also cooperating with another, you know, power, a segment of the power elite, but that one that's more like transnational in that sense, right? Because there's a lot of competition among the elite. You know, they don't all think the same. There's infighting and they want different things and all of this, right? So
you
can't look at it monolithically.
Totally agree. And you've done a good job on breaking that down in the past between. And that's always important because we tend to fall into this kind of pitfall of assuming that it's, you know, it's pretty obvious there's a coordinated agenda happening right now, but not that everybody within that has exactly the same mindset of where it should end up, right?
Yeah, right.
That's important. Well, let's bring this over to the gaslighting discussion, since I know we are limited on time. And I think this is a really important thing to make sure what we see and discuss, because as I shared when I talked about this the first time, is that James Corbett is somebody I think is important to reference on the coverage that should be pointed to kind of counterbalance what this is, because he's done such a great job. And people tend to I always point at James Corbett because I feel like he's one of the few people out there that has done such an amazing job of always, always at all costs being objective about what they're discussing, you know, and giving all sides of a conversation. As many know, I absolutely have grown up on that work in regard to being inside in this media field and emulate what he does for that exact reason, because that's what we should be doing. So before we, you know, the reason I say that is because I have his information here we'll talk about next. But before we get into that, so here's a recent article that was put out, the title being Where the Notorious Dancing Israelis 9/11, or excuse me, Were the Notorious Dancing Israelis 9/11 Plotter Spies or Just Common Scam Artists? So why don't you start on giving your thoughts on where this was going, what the intentions might have been, and why you think it's not accurate.
Yeah, I thought this was a really disappointing piece, and I want to stress that I'm saying this from a professional perspective, not a personal. This isn't like a beef or anything. I'm trying to start. But what I was talking about, you know, some of the people I was thinking about when I wrote that op-ed for Gray Zone, you know, I was thinking about some Gray Zone contributors like Aaron Matei, who have been very explicit about how they don't want anything to do with anyone who has ever advocated for 9/11 truth. Matt Taibbi being another one, some people like that. He doesn't contribute to Grayson, I don't think, but, you know, just some of the people I had in mind when I was writing that particular piece. So it was disappointing that this is the piece that Grayzone chose to publish to commemorate 20 years of 9/11, considering that they're an outlet that frames itself as covering a lot of the egregious overreaches and human rights violations and other things caused by the war on terror. Obviously a direct result of 9/11. And so basically, based on David Sheen's conclusions here and what his tweets about this, this was an investigation where he essentially looks at the case of what is commonly called the Dancing Israelis. But, you know, obviously it's a little bit of a misnomer if you actually know much about the case and the FBI themselves called them the 9/11 high fivers. Essentially, it's about five Israeli citizens in the U.S. working for a company determined by the FBI to be a front for the Mossad called Urban Moving Systems. Basically, David Sheen, in his tweet, for example, about this article, as he summarized the conspiracy theory he was trying to debunk about these five individuals, was that some people think that these particular five individuals were responsible themselves for the 9/11 attacks, among other things. From my understanding, it was that they, the concern, the accusation is that they had foreknowledge that something was going to happen to the towers. They were in a particular position waiting for something to happen that had a good view of the Twin Towers. And then once the planes hit, they were viewed celebrating by residents of this apartment complex they were parked. They took photographs of themselves where they are all visibly jovial and celebrating per the FBI report. These pictures were believed to have been destroyed for a very long time. They were obtained by a Freedom of Information Act request in 2019. I wrote a report on that when I was still working for Mint Press News full time. But the faces were redacted, so you can't see their facial expression. But we know from the FBI reports and from other things and eyewitness accounts that they were celebrating, the destruction of the towers on 9/11. So,
yeah, I mean, sorry.
No, it's fine. There's a lot to say. So,
yeah. Well, I wanted to include this. Somebody recently sent to me. It's just the archive of one of the original discussions on ABC. And those that have actually seen and watched, and which I highly recommend, not just the 9/11 suspects dancing Israelis part of his coverage, but yeah, James Corbett's overall coverage of the 9/11 suspects, it gets into this information. But the interesting archive of the original report, where the lady was on record saying, yes, we saw them. They were high-fiving. They were jumping around. I mean, there's certain things that are factual about this that you can't dismiss that the mainstream coverage deem as fake news, which is ridiculous, right? It's on report, such as like the FBI going around and arresting other, you know, arguable Mossad agents in this time frame because of this, or the fact that these people later admitted they were part of Mossad, and these kind of things that on live TV, you know, there's a lot of this stuff that we just kind of kick to the side. And so it's very frustrating that the evidence is there. And again, all this brings to where we are today.
Well, beyond the dancing Israeli thing, people need to keep this whole case in context too. There was a lot of odd Israeli espionage activity going on within the United States, particularly in the New York metro area around the time of 9/11, not just urban moving systems and this whole particular scenario here, but you know, there was also the case of Amdocs, Converse, Infosys, those companies, and also the Israeli art student situation where it appeared to be an espionage operation specifically targeting the DEA media roots. And Robbie Martin have done a really good work on that. And before them, Chris Ketchum had done probably like the best reporting on the Israeli art students thing. So this wasn't, you know, just isolated to urban moving systems, and keeping it focused on that, you know, we have to keep in mind that there was obviously some weird Mossad activity going on within the United States that was targeting the U.S. government in some way. What does that mean? Mm-hmm. Does that mean necessarily that, you know, if you want to explore those possibilities, does that mean that you must believe that Israel was fully responsible for 9/11? No, but you know, at the very least, it raises the unsettling possibility that they were aware that there was going to be some sort of attack on that day and they didn't warn about it. And they obviously benefited, the Israeli security state benefited from 9/11 in the sense of the war on terror, benefiting a lot of Israeli geopolitical interests, the removal of Saddam Hussein, for example, benefiting them as well. And Netanyahu famously saying positive reverberations around the region and all of this stuff. So, you know, there, I think those are issues that any rational person looking at this, you know, there seems to be something there. And the more you look into some of the stuff, you know, there are concerns. If you're of the opinion that aspects of the U.S. deep state, the national security state intelligence agencies, whatever, were involved in nefarious activity on 9/11 and thereabout, frequently those intelligence agencies and organizations collaborate with their counterparts in Israel. Mm-hmm. So it really isn't that insane as it's been painted to consider that there's possibilities here. You know, frequently even considering these possibilities is out of the door accused of anti-Semitism. Right. The gray zone doesn't do that, thankfully, but they do. this particular piece is just odd. I would encourage people to read it and maybe compare it to some of the coverage I did of at Mint Press of this particular case, and like you said, James Corbett's video. There's a lot of FBI documentation about this, some of which David Sheen, you know, says, oh, how could, you know, takes the FBI at face value and says, this is what the FBI said, and thus this is what we should believe, but then takes the word of the Israelis that were either arrested or the guy that ran urban moving systems, Dominic Sutter, which the FBI concluded was a Mossad front.
Right. And later was removed and it no longer existed, right, after the follow-up. I mean, that's one of those things that are factual that get kind of dismissed as conspiracy theory. And
So, you know, this is supposedly to debunk the conspiracy theory that these guys were spies, this article. That's essentially what's going on here, and saying that they were just common scam artists. The title sort of implies that. But unfortunately, that largely, if you read the article, it largely relies on the testimony of the Israelis involved themselves. Several decades after the fact. And one of these, for example, one of the main points is that when these guys were arrested by U.S. authorities, their truck was stopped and stuff, you know, in 2001. oh, sorry, I lost my train of thought there for a second. I'll remember it later. But there's a lot of things about this that it's hard to paint them as common scam artists. Some of this is not mentioned in the article. The fact that when they were stopped, for example, they had one of them had a sock stuffed with $5,000 in cash. There was explosive residue found in their van. They had box cutters. The way they behaved when they were stopped and saying the Palestinians are responsible for 9/11. We know it for sure. And like all of this stuff, you know, I mean, there's a lot of oddities that points to it not being just like common scam artists. in addition to the fact that the moving company they worked for was a front for Mossad, they had moving vans, but they didn't have equipment normally seen in moving vans in their vans at all. It was like something else. And that these, the dancing Israelis, 9/11 high fivers, when their names were put through a database, they came up as Mossad operatives in a CIA FBI joint database. And so that was sort of debunked by David Sheen by interviewing one of the people involved. And they were saying, oh no, well, actually one of those guys was only involved with the Jewish agency. And so that's why he came up in that database, but that's taking his word for it. And did they supply evidence to prove that? Or are you just, you know, taking their testimony for it and then focusing in on that and ignoring a lot of the other evidence around this case that really makes it pretty clear that these individuals are not necessarily to be trusted and that they were involved in espionage activity. He references an article from the Forward from 2002 that concluded that Israel's own government said they were involved in espionage activity in the United States when they were there.
Yeah, that's undeniable. I mean, that's been undeniably proven 100 times over, not even just around 9/11. Go ahead.
So, you know, trying to paint them just as common scam artists. And, you know, I think it's a problematic piece that doesn't really want to deal with the broader questions raised by the situation. And I think it's, you know, kind of unfortunate because, you know, okay, if you're going to try and put a rest to this case and debunk it, the way this was carried out doesn't do that. Right. Sort of cast shade on the outlet that published it. And, the, you know, as opposed to, because I'm left a little speechless, honestly, because it's a little, you know, a little dumbstruck to see it that day. I certainly didn't expect it, right? But it's, you know, if you're trying to debunk the case, you have to lay all the facts out there. You have to be really transparent. You have to be really lay it all out and let the people reach their own conclusions. Okay. And so there's a lot of like key pieces of evidence surrounding this particular case that were not addressed. And sort of this thing, like, you know, it also has this aspect to it, the article of like, well, the Israelis weren't really dancing. So, you know, conspiracy debunked, but the whole point was never
right.
I mean, that was just a nickname applied to them. It was never about them dancing or whatever. You know, also ignored is the fact that one of the guys went on Israel. They all went on Israeli TV afterwards, mm-hmm. after returning to Israel. And one of them says, we were there to document the event. I don't know what that, the event being 9/11. So I don't really, you know, how is that just common scam artist activity and nothing else? It's a little, it's just now, odd.
On live TV in Israel, I forget if it was live or not, but it was aired live on Israeli TV, right? I mean, that's an important point. And to add to something to you were saying before, and this is what we're seeing, not just on this one topic, but just constantly from manipulation, is that they're constantly playing into one part of this, like you're saying, where it's like, well, here's the one thing we're talking about and we omit all the rest of it. And of course, that is an intentional deception around all the other parts that show you that doesn't add up. As Corbett always points out, if a title ends in a question mark, the answer is probably no. Right. That's usually how these things tend to go. It's like you're leaning into one part of it. Like I of course, my audience knows I can't stop thinking about all the stuff that's happening today where it keeps drawing parallel. But it's the same with everything else we're seeing today, where you will talk about something and they'll dig into one point that they say from one thing that the CDC's made and ignore all the peripheral information, all the other studies. There's so much information around why these people and the larger point I was trying to make there, I get trailed off, is that it's not about proving that they did this or proving that they danced. It's about proving that, or at least showing information that suggests quite strongly that they did have foreknowledge, such as saying they were at a document or that they were celebrating after something happened and the person caught it from the window. Like, you can't just dismiss that stuff, right?
Yeah. Well, you know, one thing that isn't brought up in David Sheen's article is the fact that the FBI report, right, asked the question, did these guys have foreknowledge of the event? Okay. And the answer is like 2.5 pages long and it's redacted in its entirety. So the answer is obviously not like a short no.
Right.
You know, why do they have to redact all of it, all 2.5 pages? I mean, if you're familiar with incidents like this, and how redactions are meant to like make very little of little of anything of use actually publicly available. Mm-hmm. You know, I mean, it's quite telling, I think. So, you know.
Yeah, I completely agree. I mean, even the fact that their faces were removed is something I always point out. That's just there's really no logic behind it other than keeping their facial expressions from the view. I mean, this is where they're all together going, like, you know, it's obviously an interesting picture that without that removes the context.
Well, they also, like, when they actually released these pictures, they only released, like, 14 of, like, over 70. Right. And they were, like, photocopies of photocopies of photocopies, so you can't even see the towers in the background that were originally there. And they also have the faces redacted. So all you can really see are, like, their clothes. You can't really obtain any information from them. It's just... you know, there.
Which a common tactic, like sort of like the one that brings to mind right now is with the Iran situation and Lipit mines, where we had this big conversation about, oh, look, they're putting Lipit mines on the boat. Weird how it's this really grainy black and white clipped video. And then you find out later it's much longer and it's in color. And you go, why would they possibly do that? Because they wanted it to be hard to discern what was happening. You know, it's like there's an these are the things that always make me laugh out loud, that people caught within the political paradigms refuse to acknowledge how silly that is. Can we not all just be honest and acknowledge that the reason they make it hard to see and cut things out is because they don't want you to see certain parts of it, which is inherently pointing to dishonesty.
Yeah. And you know, if you are an outlet that prides yourself on challenging the narratives put out by intelligence agencies, and you are going to debunk something based largely on the testimony of people who were, you can prove, were involved with those same intelligence agencies, I think that's really problematic and raises a lot of questions. So I really hope that the Gray Zone chooses to address that at some point. Maybe they won't. Yeah. But I think, you know, this whole desire, you know how there's sort of this saying where, like, you know, there's this political class, they call them like progressive except for Palestine. They have they check all the boxes, but they don't want to go that far. There's a class of that in independent media that we've sort of been talking about that will, you know, check all the boxes, but they, 9/11, no, you know?
Yeah.
And I think... a desire to maintain that may have provoked the publication of this particular piece.
Totally agree.
Ken
O'Keefe always points out, or he has in the past, that 9/11 is a litmus test for people in this field. And I've always agreed with that, right? I mean, that's a huge paramount conversation. And on that same note, isn't it interesting and very telling that there are conversations that we're just not allowed to have? COVID's obviously one regard vaccines right now.
Yeah. But
we all know them, right? I mean, the discussion or anything even remotely peripherally around the conversation of the Holocaust, off limits, can't talk about it, right? I mean, there's a lot of these things. And it's like, it just shows you, why is that the case, right? Why can't we talk about 9/11 in a really objective way? Why can't we talk about something like that? Honestly, I would admit I find to be very clearly not the case, but let's talk about flat earth theory and make us, you know, it can't do it because you're crazy conspiracy theorist. You've even entertained the crazy, you know, where it goes. We need to be able to have these conversations. Otherwise we don't end up having a full picture, you know, and this, unless you want to get into anything else. And just so we're clear on that, I don't believe flat earth theory. I'm using it as an analogy to point out that we should.
Careful. Someone will twist it.
I'm sure they will. But I make that point all the time, is that we should be able to have conversations about things that even if we do think that they're not real, you know, or are crazy or whatever. So unless you want to get into anything else around the 9/11 side of this conversation, how about we use the last, you know, 10, 12 minutes of this to talk about the COVID overlap and other things around that that you find interesting, because we haven't connected in a while. So, because this is a part that can't get past, is this obvious connection between the bill. And I think your work is a lot of the reason I see it this way, the security state that clearly led into the biosecurity state. And I guess just a question to start you off is, do you think that this was a continuing plan that was initiated only because they now have the technology to make that the case? That's kind of where my mind is with all this, you know. Take it wherever you want to go.
So I think after 9/11, there's a couple different ways of looking at that particular operation and what came after. There's obviously the impact it had on foreign policy, the war on terror, right? And there's also the domestic results, the consequences of that resulted in a loss of civil liberties, the Patriot Act, the extreme growth of a domestic surveillance apparatus, and also international surveillance apparatus. But, you know, But people more often than not, when looking at these situations, tend to focus more on the foreign policy aspect than the domestic aspect. I think both are important. And as I've talked about before, you know, things like total information awareness, some things they really tried to implement after 9/11, they couldn't do. And it wasn't just technology. It was also, I would argue, consolidation of the media. There was too much complaining from groups like the ACLU, from even the New York Times, saying that total information awareness would eliminate civil liberties and all of that. Total information awareness still exists as Palantir, essentially, in different pieces of those same projects. Facebook, even, you know, coming out of DARPA's life log. And stuff like this, you know, and now the ACLU, for example, this the type of complaints they were putting out about the Patriot Act and after 9/11 and all that stuff, you know, with COVID-19, you know, it's very different. And I guess they obviously did a lot of polling, I think, on this, you know, okay, so with the problems we ran into with terrorism and the war on terror, how can we get around that? And the public health justification, I think, has gone quite far for them in allowing them to sort of fill in the gaps there. Because we're also in the U.S. Don't forget that there's also a war in domestic terror happening at the same time. So you have one COVID-19 filling in the gaps of the other from the perspective of the national security state, right? Which I think is important to point out, because the stuff they want to do that they can't be with one, they'll be doing with the other. And that's why they're both happening at the same time.
Very revealing. So the domestic part of that, though, right now, that overlap is never, that has never been more clear. And I continue to point out that even the body is your battle, your body is the new battlefield. These kind of ideas where you were laying these out the beginning of the middle of 2020. It's obvious that's where we are right now. Right.
So, yeah, well, one of the main parallels too, is this whole invisible enemies thing. Right. Mm-hmm. So anthrax was meant to be that too. But like I said earlier, anthrax, the whole narrative fell apart and it became a forget as opposed to a never forget thing, from 2001. But the idea is the same. In the sense, and so in my op-ed in Mint Press, I talk about how we've been living basically a 20-plus year pandemic of fear over invisible enemies. And that's basically one of the main points of continuity from 2001 on, that you know, we've been experiencing the U.S. collectively as a nation, and then now, of course, it's gone international far beyond it was just a couple years ago. And I think, you know, all of that is really significant. And there's a lot going on internationally. I think there's, like, you know, efforts to sort of test out, see how far they can take it in one country and try and replicate it in another country. But, you know, I've talked about this with Vanessa Beely before, who I'm sure most people are familiar with her work on the White Helmets, and James Le Monsieur, Missouri, I forgot how to say his last name, the UK guy tied to UK military intelligence that created the White Helmets. He gave speeches before he died about how they had done polling about who people trust the most, right? And it was like rescue workers, public health workers. And that's why the White Helmets ended up being what they were, as opposed to another type of group for the particular, you know, operation that or particular role they were meant to serve in promoting the war in Syria abroad, right? Mm-hmm. And so I think that same type of polling was used by the people looking to sort of create a global 9/11 before COVID ever happened, right?
Yeah.
Back in the planning phase, you know, this is back several years ago, right? So I think this was deliberately, you know, aspects of this obviously had to have been planned going years back. But, you know, there's a lot we don't know. And I think it'll be that way for a long time. I mean, it's the same thing with 9/11 too. Yeah. You know, even 20 years on, there's been a lot of people looking at this stuff over the years. A lot of evidence has been destroyed, was destroyed early on. And then the censorship, things keep disappearing from the internet that used to be there. And, you know, that's probably only going to get worse with time. and, you know, really complicates the work of people like you and me and others who are trying to sort of make sense of all of this. But, you know,
information awareness, right? That's exactly what is happening right now. Same thing.
Well, point. Yeah. Well, I talked about this in my 9/11 lawyers committee talk, is that a lot of these same projects are happening now. And that's been something I've been talking about in my work over the past year and a half specifically, is that a lot of things they couldn't succeed in doing after 9/11, they've implemented now in through Total Information Awareness and some other stuff. And that's why you see Palantir pop up with all the COVID-19 data stuff, not just in the US, but the UK. Because they are Total Information Awareness, just a privatized version of it, because they realized that people didn't freak out as much when it was a private sector thing, as opposed to a public thing. Well, Total Information Awareness with DARPA was originally a public-private partnership, exactly. But it was framed in the media as being the military DARPA, and thus it's bad because the military is doing it, and then they make it a private sector thing entirely in it. And it's fine, you know, but they're at the center, and even the New York Times, and they did like this big report on, I think, Palantir at the end of last year, the end of 2019. And they just call it the all seeing eye Palantir. It's like text leading, like this weird graphic of an eye with that text in it and stuff. I mean, it, a lot of fodder for conspiracy theorists, isn't it? You know, so there's a lot going on, but the main thing I want to stress about this, you know, 20 years after 9/11, is that we're prevented from seeing these continuities and the big picture and the end game by refusing to acknowledge some of these hard truths about 20 years ago and the things that have happened since. And we really need to start doing that work, because we don't have 20 years to wait anymore. You know, stuff is happening right now, and it's everything's really on the line. And I really hope people can see that at this point.
Yeah, I completely agree. And thank you for joining and speaking about this today. I know we only got a couple minutes left. I think that the last thought here that really sticks in my mind with this, and you did a great job of really showing this overlap. I love the point about, you know, accomplishing one goal from two angles with two different points, you know, security state, biosecurity state, is that right now we're hearing them say, and I just watched the mainstream media say this about the global South versus the United States, that nobody's safe until everybody's safe. Now, if there's not an obvious overlap between where we started 9/11 to where we are now in that one statement, I can't, if there's not more, I don't see it, you know? So thank you for being here. And any one last statement you want to leave us with before we let you go?
Sorry. I wish I had a punchier line, I guess, but I guess that was the one I had just ended, but I can rehash it a little bit. But really, you know, we're at a point where everything's on the line. A situation is being created to deprive a large group of people of their freedoms entirely. And so the group in the past supporting that was against that happening to particular ethno-religious groups. For example, after 2001, but now this is being framed as, oh, it's okay because these people have chosen, it's voluntary, right? But, you know, I mean, this same tactic has been, you know, people have been whipped up into this frenzy, and it can be applied to anyone, you know, okay, so it's the unvaccinated today, but I mean, you give this kind of power to the state and the national security apparatus, it's going to be a nightmare. And I think people need to realize that sooner rather than later, definitely sooner rather than later.
I couldn't agree more. And I mean, that's really, we have to remember, time to act is absolutely now. And I never mean violence, but the time to act is now. Thank you so much for being here, Whitney. It's always a pleasure. As always, everybody out there, question everything. Come to your own conclusions. Stay vigilant.